In our first story, Behind Mansion Walls, a family man.
Nice wife and a nice house.
With a fatal flaw.
He's just a son of a bitch.
And later, when a Rockefeller goes missing.
His bank accounts weren't touched. His credit card wasn't used.
No one can believe where he's found.
A long way from church and children. I mean, what the hell was going on there?
I'm Christopher Mason. Money may grant prestige, but it doesn't change who you truly are. Your secrets won't vanish, your flaws won't fly away, and it's no easier to tame your hidden desires.
Is my wife. I found her in the bathtub. She's unresponsive. I think she hit her head.
It's every husband's nightmare. One minute, your wife is alive. Stephanie. The next, she's a corpse.
She'd been found dead in the bathtub.
Oh, my God.
An awful accident or something more sinister. A fox hunt bugle. The whinny of a well-bred stallion. It's the sound of just another day on Philadelphia's main line. The vast estates are home to billionaires. And waiting in the wings, dreaming of mansions of their own, are the upwardly mobile residents of nearby Lower Merion.
It was a great place to live if you were trying to show that you were a businessman on his way up.
On a leafy avenue lives a couple enjoying the trappings of success. And they seem certain to climb even higher up the main line.
Craig Rabinowitz and Stephanie Rabinowitz lived in the most affluent community of Montgomery County.
Hi, gorgeous man.
Which itself is an affluent place, one of the wealthiest counties in America.
Hi, gorgeous girl.
Craig is an entrepreneur with an import business. Stephanie, a promising young lawyer at a firm in the city.
She had a good law practice, was well-liked, very attractive, and was an up-and-comer. Craig was a popular guy.
Yeah, she ate it.
He was especially popular among the wives of their friends because he always seemed to be available. If they needed something done, they could, oh, we'll just call Craig and he'll take care of it.
He takes good care of his wife and daughter, too.
He paid a lot of attention to his daughter. He played with her a lot. And they just seemed to be a perfect little family.
Certainly, from all outward appearances, Craig and Stephanie and their beautiful daughter had an idyllic life.
Bye, Daddy.
Their daughter's first birthday is coming up. But her mom won't be around to celebrate it.
This is my wife. I found her in the bathtub. She's unresponsive. I think she hit her head.
Craig Rabinowitz called the 911 center and said that his wife was unresponsive in the bathtub.
Stephanie is rushed to the hospital in the early hours of April 30th, 1997. But there's nothing doctors can do. The young mother is dead.
Her husband had told the police that she had gone in to take a bath. He was watching the hockey game, fell asleep, noticed his wife wasn't there in bed with him.
Stephanie?
Went to investigate. Found her dead in the bathtub.
He said, well, you know, I heard a thump and she must have fallen and hit her head and then drowned.
13A, 61, 13A, 61, the death is both tragic and unusual. Cops aren't sure if Craig's explanation for it holds water.
I mean, here was a young woman with no disabilities, no apparent diseases or illnesses, and she drowned. And they just, that just doesn't happen that often.
Policeman sizes up the situation.
He looked at Stephanie and said, she's got jewelry on. He says, one woman takes a bath with her jewelry on.
A good question. So medical examiner Dr. Ian Hood is called in to investigate.
The emergency room physician who had handled her case was curious, just for the same reason everybody else was. Why does a previously healthy 29-year-old woman suddenly die in a bathtub?
It doesn't take Dr. Hood long to find his answer.
As soon as I saw her body, it was obvious that she had been strangled. The autopsy just confirmed that there were deep bruises in the neck consistent with strangulation and no other reason for her to be dead.
There's another odd thing. Dr. Hood discovers traces of sleeping pills in Stephanie's blood.
She had about 2 or 3 pills worth in her body at the time. She's a 29-year-old, busy working mother of a 1-year-old. She had no need of sleeping assistance at all.
Dr. Hood's conclusion? Stephanie's death was no accident.
Well, that changes, of course, dramatically the way we approach it.
When the police started looking for a suspect, they looked around and said, said there were only 3 people in this house. One of them's dead and the other's a baby, and who does that leave?
Craig is brought in for questioning. Friends and family are outraged. This loving father and all-around nice guy couldn't be responsible for his own wife's murder.
They said, why would you arrest Craig? He was such a good guy. He wouldn't kill his wife.
But former Montgomery County DA Bruce Castor begs to differ. He charges Rabinowitz with murder.
Stephanie Rabinowitz's family and Craig Rabinowitz's family totally believed in his innocence and were completely against us, especially Stephanie's family, thought that I was the worst man in the world.
Bruce Castor's reason for getting Rabinowitz in custody quickly? He's heard a rumor that Craig might be planning a trip.
We were able to uncover people that said that he was trying to get their help to flee. He had packed a suitcase which had the unfortunate name of Runaway. The brand name was Runaway. So we had to move quickly because we thought that he was fixing to flee.
Authorities stalked Craig at his wife's funeral before making their move.
We followed him to the funeral and filmed it and all that in case we would get anything. And then we arrested him right after the funeral.
Craig's supporters say he had no motive. They suggest the murderer could be a well-dressed stranger who knocked on a neighbor's door the night of Stephanie's death.
Craig says somebody slipped into their house and killed his wife. He said, that must have been what happened. He said, somebody broke into my house and killed my wife. He said, I had nothing to do with it.
While Stephanie's family rallies around her loving husband, Craig, his nice guy mask begins to slip. Before Stephanie is even buried, Craig takes her cherished engagement ring to the pawn shop.
Why would a grieving husband and self-described successful entrepreneur do that? Investigators dig into Craig's past and discover stains on his squeaky clean image.
During the course of this investigation, I got a call from a friend of mine saying, Bruce, listen, that guy you're investigating, Craig Rabinowitz, he was the main witness in a big prostitution investigation that we conducted several years ago. And Craig was caught as one of the Johns in that and testified in that case.
In that case, Craig avoids criminal charges, but his penchant for pleasures of the flesh continues. And cops learn that now he's got a favorite girl.
They got an anonymous phone call, and this caller said, look at this woman named Summer in this gentleman's club.
And look, they did. But no one realizes exactly how favored Summer is until new evidence emerges at the crime scene.
When we searched his house, one of the things that we found hidden in a crawl space in an attic was a big shopping bag. Inside there were receipts for all of the gifts that he had showered on her.
And he was spending a lot of money on her.
And that's not all that cops find.
I was on scene when we did the search. I was so bowled over by that discovery, I concluded that what I was holding in my hand was a smoking gun.
It's spring in Philadelphia. Craig Rabinowitz has a beautiful house and a perfect family.
I have to go.
But he can't stop dreaming of Summer.
Tall, shapely, blonde, long legs and long arms and curves in the right places. There was a lot to look at there, and you can certainly see how any red-blooded American man would think that that was an attractive woman. I certainly did.
Craig's wife has no idea that instead of checking in at the office, her husband is spending his days with a stripper.
He wasn't doing any work at all, and he was spending his life at what we call here a gentleman's club, which is a strip joint.
And he fell head over heels in love with Summer. And he would buy expensive champagne, and he would give her money on the side.
He would go into a separate part of this one strip club in Philadelphia. And if you paid extra, you got more close attention, as it were. Craig began to shower her with expensive gifts, furniture, jewelry, and this sort of thing. And it was costing him tens of thousands, ultimately hundreds of thousands of dollars, to keep the stripper's affections.
Summer loving happened so fast. And now Craig Rabinowitz is in way over his head. Wife and child at home, a neglected business, and a stripper who loves spending his money. Some things gotta give.
Craig was getting deeper into debt. And he was getting worried about this. And he didn't know exactly how to get himself out of this hole he dug.
At first, Craig tries to get his friends to bail him out by investing in his so-called lucrative import business.
Craig claimed to be importing gloves from Asia, the gloves the doctors and health workers use to keep their hands sterile. And he claimed to have a corner on this market where he would import gloves and then sell them at a tremendous profit.
The margins are unbelievable.
He would go to his friends and say, hey, you know, we got a little downturn, we need some more money.
Aren't you glad your credit card has details?
Large sums of money, tens of thousands of dollars, ultimately hundreds of thousands of dollars, into this venture.
There's so much money to be made in these gloves, the whole medical industry.
It's a scam that would only make Craig's predicament worse.
It's the old story. If it seems too good to be true, it probably is. You know, lending money to Craig Rabinowitz on his word that you're going to make a lot of money on the latex glove business, that was a risky venture.
Sounds great. Where do I sign?
Craig would exaggerate his sales. And what he was doing was he was running what they call a Ponzi scheme.
Thank you.
That only keeps going as long as you can get people to invest. Well, it reached the point where no one wanted to give him any more money, and they wanted their money back.
Hi, David. Now, listen, I got a bit of a cash flow problem. I was wondering if I could borrow some more money.
So it became paramount that he have a large amount of money quickly.
Craig's arrest for his wife's murder is already big news. But with Summer on the scene, it's officially a frenzy.
It was a case that gathered quite a bit of attention, especially when Summer entered the picture.
They had a photograph of her in a lascivious pose around a pole, scantily clad, and she was a very attractive woman. It sold more copies of the newspaper than had ever been sold in history up to that time, including JFK assassinated, man lands on the moon, World War II ends, the whole thing.
Meanwhile, forensic accountants have deciphered the contents of Craig's bag of secrets, including a revealing ledger.
It was a list of all of the people that he owed money to and all of the money he would get in the event of Stephanie's death, including life insurance, proceeds on the sale of the car, joint bank accounts, and all of this other stuff. It was a roadmap for how he was going to clear his debts if he killed Stephanie and how much money he'd have left over.
At the heart of Craig's get-rich-quick scheme is his wife's life insurance policy. Finalized just 3 weeks before she died and worth up to $2 million.
Craig finally came to the idea that, you know, what I can do is I can buy a big insurance policy on Stephanie and kill her and collect the policy. And that was going to be his ticket to freedom.
Craig Rabinowitz is put on trial. Prosecutors believe they have a motive for murder and are confident of a conviction.
I wanted to go into court and really beat him badly because I wanted him to feel the wrath of the government coming down upon him for what he did.
Prosecutors never get that chance, thanks to an extraordinary story from beyond the grave.
Craig had been protesting his innocence all this time until the day the trial was supposed to start.
Jury comes in, the courtroom is packed, there's media everywhere. When the defense attorney came over and said, this is gonna be a short hearing. And I go, what do you mean? We're all ready to go.
But Craig has an announcement.
He said, I had a dream last night. And Stephanie and I and her father, who was also dead, were sitting around a table. And Stephanie grabbed his hand and said,
Craig, it's time to do the right thing.
You have to tell them what happened.
You have to tell them what happened.
He knows the right thing.
I murdered my wife.
The courtroom is in shock. Rabinowitz blames the murder on a moral disconnect that left him unable to tell right from wrong.
He said, I thought it was going to be better all the way around. I thought it was going to be good for our child. I thought it was going to help me with my debts. And he said, I'm very sorry, but that's what happened.
It's all nonsense. I mean, he had planned to kill her for months because that's why he took out the big life insurance policy and all that.
Rabinowitz's confession shocks even those closest to him.
I talked to a couple of Craig's friends. They wanted to remain anonymous, so I didn't name them, but they were truly shocked about what had happened. And that Craig had done it. And to the end, they kept saying, no, Craig didn't do it. There's some kind of mistake. The police have screwed this up. And when Craig pleaded guilty, they said, oh, man. I said, I just can't believe he did that.
Investigative reporter Ken Englade, who specializes in writing books about real court cases, had come to Philadelphia specifically for the trial. When Craig's confession comes, Englade almost cancels his book on the Rabinowitz case.
I came to Philadelphia in anticipation of seeing a trial. And I'd rented an apartment for a limited time, like 2 weeks. And I'd been out and bought groceries. And I was settling down to have a beer and watch TV. And I turned on the local news, and they said, Craig pleaded guilty. And I said, oh, God. Everything's gone. You know, all my research is dead, you know, because my books depend a lot on the courtroom activity. There wasn't going to be any trial. And I thought I was dead. And so I went to the district attorney and I said, look, I came here to do a book on this. And I said, I'd really like to do it. Will you guys help me? And the district attorney, Bruce Castor, was very gracious, and his top assistant and the investigators were really good. I mean, they were very cooperative. The local police or the investigators in this bent over backwards to help. And they gave me access that I'd never had in any of my other books. They didn't have a fight one night and he killed her. It was very methodically done. It was very well planned.
And it was brutal.
I would guess that she did fall asleep fairly heavily. He picked her up and put her in the bath. But at that point, she began to struggle. He had to finish her off and hold her down. She had typical fingertip-type deep bruising in the neck.
It takes a long time, minimum of 4 minutes of constant pressure to stop the blood flow to the brain before someone will die.
With a guilty plea to first-degree murder, Craig Rabinowitz is handed the maximum sentence. Life without parole.
That means he goes into the slammer and he doesn't get out. He's there for life, truly for life.
In the aftermath of Craig's conviction, questions linger over the nature of his relationship with Summer.
Craig and Summer were having an affair, but it was mostly in Craig's mind. And I don't know if they were actually having a relationship, a physical relationship or not. But it didn't matter to Craig. He was happy because he had found someone who would give him sympathy and listen to him.
After the fact, as I understand it, Craig has admitted that it was a physical relationship. She never has, so that's in dispute, so I don't know. It just doesn't seem likely to me that he's buying furniture for her and jewelry and all this other stuff.
Wow, thank you.
You don't do that kind of stuff just because you have an attachment to a girl taking her clothes off in a bar somewhere. So I always sort of thought it was far more than she was making it out to be.
As a patron of Delilah's Den, Craig would while away hour after hour admiring the performer's athleticism. But he's now captivated by poles of a different kind. The cold steel bars that line his prison cell. And these days, there's no Summer in sight.
Despite all his planning, Craig ended up with nothing. When the insurance companies found out that Stephanie had been murdered and that Craig had done it, they said, yeah, we're not paying any insurance on this. So that left Craig without any money, and therefore the baby without any money.
Craig's dream of a mainline mansion remains just that, a dream.
He could have earned a place in the suburbs with a nice wife and a nice house and a nice family, could have been a productive member of society and enjoyed his weekends and nights with his friends and whatnot. Craig was a lazy man and also a coward.
He wasn't there to dally. I mean, they weren't listening to music. They weren't going to have a drink and a dance. They weren't going to discuss Proust. He was there for sex. It was in, out, slam, bam, thank you, ma'am, and go home.
January 21st, 2010. Melbourne, Australia, is a city on the brink. In a few short hours, a mystery will rock it to the core. But for now, it's a normal afternoon. Commuters board trains and buses. Rush hour traffic streams to the suburbs. And at sunset, multimillionaire Herman Rockefeller returns from a routine business trip.
He went there to look at developing some shopping center that he'd owned.
Rockefeller checks in with his wife and teenage daughter.
Those text messages were full of joy and positive outlook because his daughter had just been accepted into a medical degree at a local university.
But after those texts, eerie silence. Rockefeller vanishes.
He came home and got off his plane and disappeared.
His bank accounts weren't touched, his credit card wasn't used, he just simply disappeared off the planet.
When a poor man goes missing, it barely raises an eyebrow, much less a headline. But if you're rumored to be worth 400 million, it's hold the front page, stop the presses, and prepare for the storm.
It just went completely wild. It was one of the most sensational stories that Melbourne had seen for so long. There was the mix, the Rockefeller name, the mild-mannered man, the family who had no clue.
His wife immediately rang the police.
My husband is missing.
Because she knew, in her words, that Herman was the type of man that didn't even stop for a drink on the way home.
I've called my kids, his business partner, and nobody's heard from him, and we don't know what's happened to him.
He wasn't the sort of person that took off for days on his own or disappeared for nights or whatever. He came home.
But not tonight. And no one can figure out why.
To suddenly disappear was completely baffling to his wife. I mean, where had he gone? I mean, there was just no clues. He'd seemingly acted completely out of character.
Since the great John D. built a $600 billion dynasty, Rockefeller is a name that's reeked of riches. Born in Ohio and educated at Harvard, Herman Rockefeller has all the hallmarks of an heir to America's wealthiest family. But is he?
When Herman Rockefeller went missing, that was the question that everyone wanted to know, was he related to the American billionaire dynasty?
Family had come to Australia in the late 60s. They had the famous Rockefeller name.
But his wife made it very clear on local radio that although Herman was American as well by birth, that their family were no relation to the American Rockefellers.
Even so, speculation is rife that kidnappers or extortionists could find a rich man called Rockefeller too tempting a target to resist.
Because of Herman Rockefeller's wealth, it was supposed that anything was possible here. That he'd been kidnapped, or that there'd been some sort of espionage involvement. That there was a CIA plot there somewhere, that he must have been liquidated because of his knowledge about some bizarre scheme. So it went wild very quickly.
After 3 days, Herman still hasn't returned to his multi-million dollar mansion.
The family and the police decided to do a press conference to the media in the hope that somebody knew something about where he had gone.
No confirmed sightings of Rockefeller are reported, but a tip leads police to a country road 50 miles from the airport.
Well, the press conference was very successful because it led to the discovery of Herman Rockefeller's car.
So when this little blue Prius turns up in this country lane, it was big news.
The car has been abandoned. Its discovery only deepens the mystery of Rockefeller's disappearance.
This led to a whole new frenzy of speculation about what could have possibly happened.
Across the nation, everyone's asking questions. If it's a suicide, where's the body? If it's a kidnapping, where's the ransom note? Then, a search of Herman's office brings a revelation. Our missing man was running 5 cell phones, and his wife only knew about 1.
Whenever police see something like that, they know it equals only 1 thing, secret life.
In Melbourne, Australia, everyone is asking the same questions. Where is multimillionaire Herman Rockefeller? And just what was he doing with 5 different cell phones?
Amassing vast collections is one of the many joys of being rich. The Sultan of Brunei has more than 2,500 luxury cars, and Colombian entrepreneur Jose Mugrabi owns 800 Andy Warhol prints. But cell phones? Who collects a drawer full of cell phones? Unless they've got something to hide.
Police began to piece together Herman's secret life from these mobile phone accounts. Some had actually lapsed. One was now in the possession of a guy in Sydney called Mark.
Mark was able to tell the detectives that people were ringing Herman Rockefeller's number asking if he was still interested in swinging or having sex with strangers.
Herman was lying to everybody, it seemed. Nobody except Herman knew exactly what Herman had been up to until the police began to piece together this elaborate and carefully, closely guarded secret life.
A secret life in the swingers scene, where Herman is known as Andy Kingston.
Herman Rockefeller had been seeking sex outside his marriage with strangers for the best part of 10 years.
But how can a prominent multimillionaire keep a secret this big for this long?
If you're wealthy, money buys you privacy, and it also buys you time. As a wealthy businessman, Herman Rockefeller travelled a lot, so he had access to time on his own, and he travelled with his laptop. That's all he really needed, with his phones, to have a secret sexual life.
Just how far his activities went, we'll probably never know. And we may never know exactly how many people met Herman and what happened, because they aren't going to step forward and expose themselves of being involved in this somewhat seedy scene.
Now, cops are worried that Herman's life might be on the line. In his car, a chilling clue.
That newspaper had on it a handwritten address that was in Hadfield, which is near the airport.
That same address is also found on his in-car GPS.
Once the address was found, the police had a possible location of where Herman Rockefeller may have gone to after leaving the airport. They didn't know why he went there, so the house was put under surveillance.
Worlds apart from the leafy suburb Rockefeller calls home is this neglected house in Hadfield, Victoria. Police wonder what could possibly have lured him here.
A long way from home and church and children. I mean, what the hell was going on there?
Inside are Bernadette Denny, an alcoholic mother of 2, and her lover, 57-year-old Mario Shembri.
Hello, is this Mario? Hook up sometime.
Call records show Rockefeller had been in contact with the couple the night he went missing.
How does Tuesday sound?
It's a date.
But where is Herman now? Inside, a captive, dead. Police don't wait to find out.
After watching Bernadette Denny's house, the homicide detectives knocked on her front door and arrested her on the suspicion of the murder of Herman Rockefeller.
Denny's hostile boyfriend, Mario Schembri, is also under arrest.
Now, Bernadette Denny and Mario Schembri were the opposite of Herman Rockefeller in very many ways. They were not attractive, they were not healthy, they were not fit, they were not successful.
Yet now, their world has collided with Herman Rockefeller's. They tell detectives the man they know as Andy Kingston first visited them weeks earlier.
They'd had an earlier liaison with him where he'd come on his own and he'd had sex with Bernadette and Mario had watched.
This is despite advertising couple, seeking couple.
Bernadette Denny and Mario Schembri, they'd been together for some time. They decided they want to spice up their sex life, so they got involved in the swinging scene. Andy Kingston was one of the first people that they'd seen. This was supposed to, I guess, bring something exciting to their otherwise pretty boring lives, I guess.
Better bring your wife next time.
You know I will.
It's a promise Herman will fail to keep. On January 21st, he arrives on their doorstep a second time, again without a partner.
He was supposed to bring his partner. They were going to have some sort of form of foursome or something or other. He was very keen to have sex with Denny. Denny became insulted by this. He slapped his face.
Stop with your wife, Denny!
By arriving without a woman, Herman has violated the swingers' code. And now, he'll pay the price.
Mario had said, where's your wife? You know, you've had my missus, where's your missus?
Herman Rockefeller got punched many times by Mario Schembri. And fell and hit his head. Herman Rockefeller's body was lying on the floor. The couple didn't know what to do, but they just panicked.
Instead of taking Rockefeller to a hospital, Schembri and Denny decide to dump his body. It's a choice they will regret for the rest of their lives.
Did you hear that?
It's nothing, all right? It's nothing.
Yeah, well, I think it's him. It's him.
Oh, it's nothing. Look, just trust me, okay? I know what I'm doing.
And what they do next will be even worse.
Bernadette told the police that she vomited when she went out to the garage and she couldn't face up to what was happening.
Herman Rockefeller was the kind of man everyone looked up to.
Hello.
To his family and friends, he was obviously the successful businessman with a loving wife and a successful and happy marriage.
Hey, you are fantastic.
And a son and a daughter living in the leafy eastern suburbs of Melbourne.
Thanks. See ya.
He had a house in Robe, South Australia, a beachside property. He had another one in Hobart.
And on the other page, if you turn that page, you get into that murky world of anonymous sex and the desperate and dateless.
Millionaire property developer Herman Rockefeller had come to Melbourne's rough suburbs seeking one thing.
He was there for sex. It was in, out, slam, bam, thank you, ma'am, and go home.
Stop it, your wife!
Herman was engaging in a high-risk lifestyle. He'd set up an elaborate series of secret identities.
He's alive. She's not coming.
He put himself at risk. This was part of the attraction of what he was doing. He was taking risk.
But things had gone horribly wrong. And now, Mario Schembri and Bernadette Denny have decided to dump Herman Rockefeller's body.
They went around in the dark, and they couldn't decide what to do with him.
Why the hell are we even going to Heathrow?
You've got a better idea.
So they ended up just driving back home with the body still in the back of the car. When they got home, they put the body in the garage and then they tried to get some sleep.
Cops believe that sometime that night, Rockefeller dies. Denny and Shembri hatch a plan B that will both shock and sicken the nation.
Mario Shembri and Bernadette Denny decided to go and buy a chainsaw, some gloves and some face masks and some drop sheets.
Bernadette told the police that she vomited when she went out to the garage and she couldn't face up to what was happening when the body was being dismembered.
Australia Day, 2010. Patriotic Australians commemorate the founding of their country with a national holiday. But Mario Shembri has work to do.
Mario Shembri took the pieces of the body to a house that he knew the owner of, and he set up a drum and set fire to the pieces on Australia Day.
And in fact, he burnt so much there that the fire got so bad the fire brigade was called.
The burning made an awful smell and there was thick black smoke coming out of the backyard for 2 days. And so the neighbours complained to the local fire brigade and they came around to see a man tending a fire in the backyard. So the fire engine arrived with two firefighters in it who got out and told Mario Shembri to put whatever he was burning out, because it was a total fire ban day. So Mario Shembri went and got the hose and put the fire out in front of the firefighters. The firefighters got back in their truck and drove off, little knowing that Mario Shembri was burning a body.
As families are enjoying their barbecues, he burns Herman Rockefeller in a 44-gallon drum.
As the smoke rises, Denny and Shembri think they've disposed of Andy Kingston, the swinger, until they turn on the television.
Herman Rockefeller was last seen at Melbourne Airport. He arrived.
Like the rest of Melbourne and Australia, they watched the media and saw news broadcasts of Herman Rockefeller's face. It was then that they realised that the man they knew as Andy Kingston was the missing multimillionaire.
This wasn't some Mr. Anonymous. This was a rich and powerful person.
But there's no going back now.
He'd already been chopped up and burned. And they were already stuck with the consequences of their actions.
It was late yesterday when homicide detectives got their break.
A week after Rockefeller disappears, Denny and Shembri admit to involvement in his death. They later lead police to the yard where he was crudely cremated.
All the implements of the disposal of the body were found in pieces near the site of the burning. What they also found were some plastic bags inside other plastic bags which contained some charred matter in them. Eventually they got enough of an intact tooth and a bit of the jawbone to determine that it was Herman Rockefeller.
For years he'd flitted between two very different worlds. But this time, Herman would not return from his nocturnal escapades. The Rockefeller family is devastated, torn between grief for the man they loved and disbelief over the sordid swinger they never knew.
I'm sure they had no idea of the secret life of their fathers, and they'd probably be stunned and amazed to find out what was going on outside the family front door.
Not all of Rockefeller's liaisons were with members of the swinger scene.
As part of the investigation, the footage from the media conference was replayed and it caught the interest of one woman in Melbourne. Now, she was Herman Rockefeller's girlfriend in the early 80s, And she came forward and told the police that although she and Herman Rockefeller had broken up then, they'd actually kept on seeing each other for 27 years. Once the police found that out, the Herman Rockefeller that they were looking for had become a very different sort of creature.
The remarkable thing was he'd also been lying to his longtime mistress. She had no idea about his secret swinging life. She believed that he was going to leave his wife and come and marry her and live this monogamous life with her. She'd had no idea. So Herman was lying to everybody. It was an extraordinary, almost pathological existence he was living. He was almost different personalities, different identities. He would become Andy Kingston when he needed to go and indulge his fantasies about group sex and so forth. But otherwise, he was the loyal father and family man.
Bernadette Denny and Mario Schembri have admitted to killing Herman Rockefeller. But there's no evidence the death was intentional.
Both Bernadette and Mario pleaded guilty to manslaughter. So they got less of a sentence. There was no trial, and the matter was dealt with relatively quickly.
Mario Schembri is sentenced to 9 years in prison. Bernadette Denny gets 7. The Rockefeller family has never spoken about Herman's other life. The hidden desires that drove him remain a mystery.
We'll never really know what brought Herman Rockefeller into contact with Bernadette Denny and Mario Schembri. It's locked away in his head. And Schembri himself couldn't understand it. When he actually discovered that it was Herman Rockefeller, not Andy Kingston, he said, well, bugger me. I mean, here's this guy, he's worth millions. He could go and get any hooker in town, but he chooses us. He couldn't work it out. So I think it's very difficult for us as well.
The heart of our fellow man remains the greatest unknown until a violent act reveals its darkest secrets. Craig Rabinowitz killed his wife to fund his red light romps, while Herman Rockefeller took a walk on the wild side and never came home. Sex with no strings attached? There's no such thing. And hidden desires cannot remain secret forever. Till next we meet behind mansion walls, I'm Christopher Mason.